All right. So, thank you. We are on lesson five, as I mentioned. Did everybody get this email? Because I got an email last night from the Egyptian saying they did not. Okay, still not. Okay. Oh, you got it. Okay. Sarah. Okay. Has anybody else, the Greers, the Gibson, did not get it? Anybody else not get it? Okay. So I mentioned I've combined a few classes so that we can leave additional room at the end to do these two classes and take our time going through that. I think that based on, again, some of the questions that y'all have been asking, I think it's kind of important that we take our time and go through some of that. In the material, there are some case studies that we want to work through in dealing with those two topics, those two different age groups, if you will, of our kids. So I show this every time because I think it's critically important. You know, and the number one is number one for a reason. And I'll show you some information, some other data that support that. But it's don't expect your kids to adopt something that you haven't adopted. So if Jesus is not number one in your life, he will not be number one in your kids' lives either. So that you know, we can see evidence of that historically. You know, there are exceptions to that. I will admit that to you. First generation Christians in a family, that kind of a thing. But for the most part, that becomes very important to all of us. And we'll go through some of that. The world is going to fight us against it. You got to put a plan. That's why we want to talk about those character traits that we think are important. You know, pick out five of them that we think are critically important to our child's well-being. You must adopt those as well. And then make sure your kids adopt them and have a plan in place accordingly. We'll talk more about that. And so those sorts of things, and we when we look about, you know, the different foundation principles that this class is built on, is in parenting in general, you know, it is that trust in God's plan. Don't settle for what the world tells you to settle for. You know, work for the ideal. Understanding that all of us are me, you, your children, can make the right choices, can make the right decisions regardless of circumstances. But that's a personal thing that falls to me. Then put away yourself if you want to be successful in any relationship. Our marriages, our parenting, that serving aspect of it. And then you're going to need some additional strength that falls outside of your skill set or your capabilities. And that is where your faith has to come in. Because this is a hard undertaking that you have chosen to go down. And that becomes very, very critical. So, you know, again, just the character traits. This is an assignment. And in a couple of classes, we are going to start putting the plan together. Well, you are going to start putting a plan together with how are you going to develop these different character traits. I'll send out a Dropbox link because there's some other material on these two links here in this PowerPoint. I'll send that out so that you can have access to some of these slides, and that way you could read about some different character traits and you could decide, you know, of the ones that are up there, I tend to put the red box around the ones that I thought were important. That's not to say that the others are not. So again, we have to identify what those traits are. And exactly how we're going to go about doing it. If we want our kids to be honest, truthful, how do we do that? It, none of these things necessarily are going to happen by accident. So we have to have a plan in place how we're going to help our kids develop those classes. And this is another way to look at the same thing. And what we want you to do is to fill in the top five that you think you have to work on. And hopefully, to Mason's point last week, you know, if you've already got them, you can help your kids develop them, or you and your kids work on them at the same time. So all of that becomes very, very important. At work, have anybody read the book, Four Disciplines of Execution, 4DX? Has anybody even heard about this thing? Well, it's kind of like the latest, greatest business fad, and I am dragging the people in my company into this thing, whether they want to or not. It is a pull, because there's a lot of resistance to this. And in essence, it deals with organizations and why organizations plan well but execute poorly. Your family is an organization, and sometimes you can plan. You might have adopted a plan, but you execute it poorly, right? Whether that be your marriage, and whether that be your parenting, that sort of thing. And basically, there's four aspects that become really important. It is focusing on the wildly important. Pick one thing, whatever the one thing is. And let's focus on the wildly important goal. The WIG is what the author of this, Stephen Covey, his organization, is behind the book. So focus on the one thing. If you have 10 things, you know, that gets to be too distracting. And at work, if you set 10 objectives, typically they accomplish zero or maybe one because they're spread too thin. But let's pick one thing. One thing can we have that becomes very important? You know, Luke 12. I think that's the story of the farmer. You know that he had a wonderful, successful crop. So what was his WIG? What was his wildly important goal after he had a successful crop? Build a bigger, better barn. Right? Was that the goal? Right? What? So, how well did that work out for him? Not well at all. Why? Because he focused on the wrong goal. Right? You know, what should be the goal? What should he have been focusing on?
Laying up treasures in heaven.
Yes, laying up treasures in heaven instead of on this earth. So that should have been his goal. And if he had would established that goal, he would have focused on that goal. You know, Paul in Philippians chapter 3, but one thing I do, it's my WIG, that's my wildly important goal, the one thing I do, forgetting everything that's behind me and straining forward to what lies ahead, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of Jesus Christ. The number one goal is salvation. So we establish that as our goal, and, you know, that doesn't mean you don't have to deal with the whirlwind that life tends to throw at you. You still have to deal with those things. Kids get sick, kids wind up in the hospital, you have to do all those things, and sometimes we let all of that distract us from what's really, really important. We have to deal with those things, but we still have to come back to that, and nothing should replace the WIG. The second step in all of this is focus on leading indicators. Too many times we focus on lagging indicators, meaning, if I want to grow sales by X, then if I just wait for the end of the monthly report, I can look at sales. That's too late for me to do anything about that. I can't impact it. But what I can do is focus on other things. For our kids, a good lead, what kind of friends do they hang around? What kind of habits are they now forming? How many Bible studies do they attend? Are they active in their prayer life? You know, those sorts of things. Focus on those things. Help our kids, because the leading indicators should move us toward whatever is wildly important to us. You know, create a scorecard. It is literally a matter of a checklist. And now here's the tough part. So if on your refrigerator you create a scorecard and you have did your Bible lesson, guess whose names are also going to be on that scorecard so the kids can see them? Yours. Right? So that everybody is held accountable, because you have to do yours as well. Right? So it's also critically important. You know, if mealtime is important, that you want to have that opportunity to talk, that's okay at this age, maybe, at the age you have your kids. I think that gets a little harder as they get older and they start involved in more sports. But if you set that as a leading indicator, well, we're going to have everybody here at dinner time. That's just what my family does, and we're going to have a conference. The TV will be off, and we will be talking. I know that sounds strange, my kids would rather I just text them from across the table, but we will be talking instead of watching TV, chores, you know, things like that that develop responsibility. And then a follow-up, okay? What one thing are you going to do the next week that moves you towards your goal? What one thing? Just give me one thing. And then the following week, I ask you, you said you're going to do your Bible lesson, okay? The next week, did you do it? Okay, no, you know, I was sick, I had the flu, didn't do it. Does that mean, and I think unfortunately this happens a lot in this building, so we're out of town, we get vacation or whatever, so we missed the Bible lesson for week four. Our kids do lesson five. Never go back and do lesson four. Skipped it. No, I missed the class, so what good does it do me to do the lesson four, right? No? Under this system, you've got it now. You were sick, you're on vacation, you couldn't do it. Well, now you've got two things to do instead of just one. So again, you're holding people accountable. I know that's a business thing, but sometimes in my little frame of reference, that helps me work this. And your family, again, is an organization. And I think too many times we do have a plan, but the whirlwind of life catches us off guard, and our plans kind of get fall off to the side. And that we can't allow that to happen. So, what's wrong with kids today? You know, we talked about, you know that whole thing last week. When we look at this and we have all of this stuff and we decided, you know, we're not going to fix all these things, right? That's not exactly what this class is intended to do. But we have a lot of problems that exist with our kids. What other indicators do you see that might, you know, show that our kids are having some trouble? You know, when we went through that kind of conversation, and what was the number one answer when we tried to say, okay, what's wrong with kids today? What was the number one answer? Parents, right? So parents are the number one problem with our kids today because we are failing to do our jobs. You know, I read that article or that couple paragraphs from that one doctor. You know, parents are afraid to end sentences with a period. Everything has got to end in a question. Is that okay if the doctor checks your tonsils? Does it matter if the child says no or yes? Does it really matter? You know, when parents allow their children to choose their own gender, we have a serious problem on our hands, don't we? When that becomes an option, then how else can you... Everything else becomes a question to the child. It's whatever makes the child happy. And if you're doing your job correctly, sometimes the child is just not going to be happy. In fact, they're going to hate it and they're going to fight it. Does that make what you're doing wrong or cool? No, it makes actually the opposite. What you're doing is right, and what you're doing is loving. So that's the key, I think, with that. So the number one answer is parents. The second answer is environment. But I think sometimes that has more to do with the parents than anything else. The environment that we create for our kids becomes more problematic. You know, I've done this in a sermon once. We have 130 kids here in Embry Hills. I think this from high school down, and maybe junior high down. Studies say that it's going to look more like that in not too distant of a future. Now, if you saw your name, your child's name disappear, okay, how does that make you feel? Sorry. Would you rather be changed a child? Is that why you're like, okay, yeah. You love them both then? Well, yeah, now some families have a head start, and you know, and I try to do it so that at least if you have twins, you got somebody else that looks just like the other one, so in case something happens to the one. So, but how does that make you feel, seeing your child's name disappear? Uncomfortable? Does it make you a little angry that I chose your child to delete? I hope it makes you uncomfortable and angry and upset. I hope it does. Because that's what it's going to look like. know, I go back to when I grew up. It's a lot worse than 50% where I grew up. How many kids are still faithful? A lot worse. It's more like there's only 10% of the kids I grew up with are still faithful. So 50% I think is pretty kind of generous. I even went through Connor's age group, and it's less than 50%. So what does that mean? So if statistics show you you're going to lose, we are going to lose 50% of our kids, what does that tell you? That's a stat. That's historical data. That is personal data that I can vouch for. What are you supposed to do about it? I mean, clearly we want this. Is that, would I be wrong in assuming that this is the chart that we want? Right? So what are we going to do?
Hopefully it motivates you to take it seriously.
Yeah. I'm hoping so. If what we think we can do is beat the odds, if what we think we can do is say these stats will not apply to my family, again, that won't happen by accident. What happens by accident is this. When we don't execute a plan, this is what happens. So, yeah.
So I do a similar thing. I teach the high school class. I'll go drag out the musty old material, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a roll sheet on there from 20 years ago or more. And you go down through the names, and that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
But it's not just a roll of the dice. I mean, if you look, I remember the families. I remember the marriages that were struggling, that was behind that. I remember how involved the families were, you know, at the time. And really, you can read each name and say, I could probably do something.
Yeah.
Of course, everything's third record. You
know, sure.
But still,
sure.
It's pretty good to stay on.
Right. You know, I think that one informal survey, you know, where some kids at Florida College, I think that's, it doesn't say which college, but I'm assuming it's Florida College. The kids that come from a family where God is number one, no matter what, God comes first in our family, those kids were more spiritually active at Florida College than the kids whose parents often compromise that. So it's not, you know, I don't know what the error factor is on a survey like that, but I'm sure it's somewhat high. But that becomes important. So, again, statistics. So when, I think this is Pew Research did this, the next one is Barna. So 27% of kids that left church just wanted a break from church. 25% moved to college, so they got some level of independence. And their level of commitment waned and diminished. Now, sometimes they go on to say that's not always permanent. That once those kids graduate and have families of their own, they go back to some sort of faithful lifestyle. So, you know, so that would indicate that some of the hard work that you're going to be doing now with your kids does pay off in the long run. It's kind of a risky thing because do we know when the Lord is coming again? Don't know, so it is kind of risky. 23% made work was more important, so attendance waned because of work. 26% of the members seemed the church members seemed judgmental or hypocritical. So there was this off-putting thing that kids were experiencing when they worshipped. Didn't feel connected to the people at their church, so no. The bond is being formed. And church members were unfriendly and unwelcome. Okay. So those are just the numbers. Just doing quick math, I would say that adds up to more than 100%. However, I think that there are, so this is just numbers I pulled out from different subgroups of different things. What does those first three mean? What do you take away from the 27, 25, and 23? Yeah.
So, to me, that just says that there's not an independent living commitment in a child.
Right.
A young adult. That they're going with their family because that's what their family does. Right. Once they're independent of that family group, then.
Yeah, so the faith.
That's not something that lives in them.
Yeah, the faith is not, it's their parents' faith, not their faith. They haven't internalized it yet. So I would say the reason those things happen, to the same point, is church is not important. Church was not a meaningful part of my life. Worshiping God is not a meaningful part of my life. I went because my parents went. So when I have the opportunity to not go, I'm going to take advantage of that opportunity and not go. If we haven't made it important. The next couple, I would say, is church members seem judgmental or not. I don't know how we communicate it, but unfortunately today, there is no right or wrong, right? Isn't that what our kids learn? That, you know, if you're too dogmatic about any position on anything, then you're judgmental. There is a right and a wrong, is there not? Shouldn't our kids learn that there are certain things that are wrong, no matter how you slice and dice it, they're just wrong? And if we as a group of elders can't say that behavior is wrong, is that we're judgmental, or are we just stating facts? Now, how we communicate that, maybe, I think sometimes we do come across as hating both the sin and the sinner. I think sometimes the way we communicate it may not be correct, and we can kind of work on our wording and have our speech always seasoned. But it doesn't change the final conclusion of that, I don't think. How much time do we spend developing that bond? You know, what kind of friends do we allow our kids to hang out with? Same thing on here. You know, if all the 100% of the exposure to Christian families is three times a week at best, then that might be one of those leading indicators that says that we're headed down the wrong path. That given the chance to move out, my kids might not be as faithful. And that becomes an issue, I think. So somehow, to Kate's point, our children have to, at one point or another, make our faith, their faith. They have to decide for themselves what's right and what is wrong, I think. So faith just isn't meaningful to them, I think. You know, the church hadn't become a valuable part of their decision-making. It just was not something that they valued at all. So another way to look at this, so there's, you know, six reasons why children leave. Churches seem to be overprotective. We come across as more concerned about TV and movies than we are about anything else, and we tend to demonize anything outside of the body of Christ. So anything is. So again, I think this is Barna research. So that was some of the reasons that were churches overprotective. And I'm not sure, you know, what to draw from that. I would classify myself as an overprotective father. That's how my kids would vouch for that. And my response when they, you know, kind of bucked at that, if the worst thing I do as your father is I'm overprotective, I'm okay with that. I'm not losing any sleep over the fact that I still know exactly where you are at 23 years old, 100% of the, well, I know where your phone is 100% of the time. I may not know where you are, but I know where your phone is all the time. One of them called that stalking. And I said, absolutely, that's exactly what that is. That's a good word. It's also a euphemism for stalking is parenting. You know, so they're interchangeable words in my opinion.
Well, I guess it is possible to be too objective in one sense, right? To not let your child have the experiences that would help them develop their own faith.
Right. It would actually work against what Kate was suggesting.
But on the other hand, children might view their parents as overprotective if they don't understand the reasons for the protective measures that they're taking.
Right.
If they don't see a foundation in truth in those actions, they would seem overprotective, overbearing, hypocritical.
Mm-hmm. I think the other term is helicopter parenting or something like that. I try not to do that. That's where you are always hovering over the child all the time. And, you know, they can't skin their knees, or, I mean, even it starts fairly young. I try not to do that, although I still cringe on occasions. But
this seems to be about churches being
right
overprotective. Is that like good discipline requiring attendance?
What I read from this is, you know, every sermon has to do with TVs, movies, and entertainment that children pick. That's what I read about that. And anything outside of what the church teaches is demonized. So even, I guess, minor topics. You know, teens and 20-somethings, you know, their experience is Christianity is shallow, which I think basically means it's not relevant. So we have it in some shape, form, or fashion made faith relevant to kids. Yeah.
I wonder how much, like, overprotective parenting feeds this, you know, in the sense that, like, certainly we don't want our children to experience grief, suffering, and loss.
Right.
But if there is no grief, suffering, and loss in the world, then what is the point?
Right.
You know, like, why would Christ need to die if there is no grief, suffering, and loss? You know, like, so I think, like, we shelter our children, we pamper our children, we protect our children,
right,
and then we wonder why they don't have, you know, empathy and sympathy for people who are suffering.
Right.
They've never seen it. You know, like, if that's, I just wonder how that's like.
No, and you're probably right. Interesting what you said. Paul told the Corinthians in the second letter that one of the reasons that there is grief, suffering, and loss is so that you will learn not to just trust in yourself, but to trust in God. You know, so there is a benefit. Although as parents we hate it. I would take my kids' place in any kind of grief, suffering, and loss scenario. But is that the best thing for them? And the answer is probably not. That they have to, just like we do, we all have to appreciate what the good is at the same time. This one time I was on the phone with my boss years ago, and he was at home, and in the background I hear this big crash and this skin-curdling scream from his son. And John just kept on talking, and I'm like, John, do you need to go and see what that is? He goes, nope. There's no blood, no bones are sticking out. He was up where I told him not to be, so he needs to hurt a little bit. That was his thing. And so he just kept on talking, you know, let the kids scream. You know, he's not really all that hurt. He was doing something I told him not to do. So there's some good lessons, I think, in that. You know, churches come across as antagonistic to science. We'll talk about that in just a second. We can spend more time going through that, but you can see that there are at least reasons. Now, some of them may not make a whole lot of sense to us, but you know they are the reasons that kids seem to want to leave. So, you know, turn to 2 Timothy 4. So Paul is writing to his helpers, you know, bring me the parchments, the books, the cloak, winter time's coming, that sort of thing. But what is it, you know, but what happened to Demas? I don't know how old Demas was, but I'm assuming that he's a fairly young man, like Titus and Timothy. That I'm assuming that. I don't know if that's true or not. But Demas does what? He deserts him for what?
The world.
So something about the world was more attractive to Demas than faith, than religion, if you will, than the life that Paul was living. So something about the world was more attractive for him. So to me, you know, Demas chose the immediate satisfaction thing, right? So, Marty, wasn't there a case study about a marshmallow study or something in the material?
Yes. Oh.
Yes. You know about this marshmallow thing?
Study, but I don't know. I mean, Stephen Ballmeister.
Uh huh.
He's a professor, Harvard grad, now at Newport State. But he basically came up with a psychological experiment where he leaves a child a marshmallow and sits it on their desk, I believe, for a certain amount of time, and it leaves the room.
Uh-huh. Well, he tells them, if you don't eat this marshmallow, well, I'm going to get to. you can get two. That's kind of it. That's, right. That's
okay.
So it's a deferred gratification.
Okay.
So basically, you know, they videotape the children, and some of them, just have future time orientation. And
right.
They sit there with absolute calm and stare and wait for the second marshmallow to come. And others kind of poke at it, touch it, lick it. There's actually one girl actually ate them inside out. Like kept the
oh really
intact, but managed to kind of suck out the inside.
A problem solver.
And it's kind of humorous. But so he wrote a book called Willpower.
What was the conclusion of that study?
Well, after that, he followed up 10, 20 years later. You know, the SAT scores were wildly higher. You know,
two
of the day
right.
were the ones that had that, and other things about their life were better. More on the worldly level, of course, because that was the
sure.
this study.
Right.
But there's been some additional follow-up on that. In fact, Lindsay Mass sent me, but really 2-3 weeks ago, an additional article on that. And I think the controversy, it's not about his results so much. There were pretty clear results. The controversy was, is this something that's inherent in the kids? Some can sit there, smell it, see it, and mm-hmm. think about the second marshmallow. Others can't. They just wolf it down. And is it something inherent in their genes, or is
right.
it something in their environment? And so the paper that Lindsay sent was fairly recent, and it was kind of debunking some of his conclusions. But as I read it through, I still was left with a maybe more confident conclusion that you could actually build that character into the children. Have you seen that follow-up?
No, but I read his book. It's called Willpower.
It's more about potentially more about environment.
And the book very much draws the conclusion that you can build willpower.
Yeah.
And
okay.
he talks about decision fatigue, and you know, folks like Steve Jobs that wear the same outfit every day to avoid decision fatigue, or you know, Barack Obama wearing the same exact suit, different versions of the same suit,
uh-huh.
but to avoid decision fatigue as well as. Doing things that build up your willpower. And
these are all self-discipline kind of things. They're conscious efforts.
That's right. And so the whole point is that it's worldly success, right?
Sure.
Basically saying that he's looking for, you know, what's the greatest explanatory power in terms of worldly success. And to his point, he looks at everything, GPA, SAT score, just a lot of different variables, and mm-hmm. This study draws the conclusion that willpower has the best explanatory power, best R squared.
Okay, so I wonder to what extent then? I mean, you know, so Demas chose something more immediate, right? He some immediate gratification. He ate the marshmallow, it seems to me, right? Where Timothy and Titus may have liked it, but they did not eat. The marshmallow, and I'm wondering, you know, one of the things that we had asked, I think, I forget who asked it, that we want to develop contentment as a characteristic in our kids, right? I wonder if there's some sort of relationship between loving the present world and learning how to be content with things. I wonder if there is, but you know, we need to figure out how to build self-control, how to build contentment. Within our kids. So you have, you know, that would be a reason. You know, so modern secular influence, you know, our kids are subjected to a barrage of information more than I my brain would have exploded, I think, you know, if at 12 years old I had access to the information that kids have access to today. It's just incredible to me. And so All of the things of living by the Spirit are kind of drowned out to some extent, and that probably was something that was happening to Demas. The religion, church, being a servant of God is just cramping my lifestyle. Is that, you know, because is being a child of God viewed as just a series of no's? Don't do this, and don't do this, and don't do this, and don't do this. Or does it focus on the freedom that we find in Christ? And that is going to be, by our way, our theme for next year, freedom in Christ, Galatians 5. So we're going to focus on that. But how much of that is viewed? generationalism, I'll have to read this, it is a state of affairs where what divides us is more important than what unites us. Sadly, the church bought into this point of view and responded by designing services for specific groups and even designing churches that appealed to specific generations. The result? Division in the church, lack of community, and tensions between generations. You know, so you cater too much to what divides rather than what unites. This false in idealism. So again, if we're striving for the ideal, you know, the world is saying that that's just not doable. The other bit of information that I found interesting about this was the focus on the family. Are young people leaving? Absolutely yes. In mainline churches, whatever that it means. They're running for the exits just like adults. Church attendance always slows down at college. I think that was where I got that. So in mainline environments where the focus is primarily on entertainment and appealing to senses, then yes, kids are leaving in droves. Not so much, or it's, again, for us it's 50%, which is already entirely too high. But I think the number is that you're left with 90% abandonment as opposed to 50, but where there's solid Bible teaching going on. High faith continuity. That means something. Now, if you're under the impression that everything your child needs with regard to faith is found here, then I think you're in trouble. Your family is going to be in trouble. If 100% of their biblical exposure is found three times a week, that will not work. Because it is the family that is the key. All of this stuff has to do with churches, right? But where it begins is with you and me. You know, that's where it is. The church can supplement some of that, but if that isn't a main focal point in your home three times a week, it's just not going to cut it. So that becomes kind of dangerous, I think, in that regard. So here's what I'd like you to do. We have a couple in here where their spouse is not with them, and that's okay. So spouses, talk about this. What I want you to do is, so these are some other reasons that we've already talked about. But we need to raise the bar. We need to somehow shoot for some ideal. How can we then, what kinds of things do we need to do to raise the bar in my parenting? What do I have to do to be better at what I do? So I'd like for you to kind of, and two couples can get together. If your spouse is not with you, get with, like, you three ladies can get together, or all you five can do that. So we can all talk about what do we need to do. Because here's the thing. I'm just speaking from my own experience and from an elder perspective. If you can't talk to your kids about how do we know the Bible is real or not, then you're in trouble. If you can't have an evolution conversation with your kids versus creation, if you don't know enough about that, then that's going to be a problem. If you can't defend the resurrection, then that's a problem. If you're expecting the church to be able to do all of that for you, that's a problem. And so what we tend to deal with, and we have a, believe it or not, a fairly significant number that are doubting the resurrection, that sit right next to you in worship, and they're doubting the resurrection, or they're doubting that the Bible is reliable. They're just these doubts. Now they're younger, but they're doubting that. So somehow those seeds are being planted in our kids, and they're doubting whether or not Jonah was actually swallowed by a big fish. They doubt whether wine could be made out of water. There's a lot of doubts that are creeping in, and you need to be able to talk to your children when they start attending science, and they're studying biology in junior high, when they're studying physics in high school. You know, you can call Marty all you want, but that, you know, someday he may not be able to respond to that. You need to be able to discuss those things with your kids. So the great news is, some of you don't even have a child in the home yet. That day's coming, and the rest of your children are very young. You have time now to start studying. You might divide and conquer. You might say, okay, I'm going to study evidences in evolution. You study the resurrection and the reliability of the scriptures. So that between the husband and the wife, you can answer those questions. So we need to raise the bar of what we're capable of talking about. Okay, so we can kind of forget about breaking up into groups and doing that. I apologize for that. And you were looking forward to it. I know you were. But we somehow have to raise the bar. I do want you to fill this in, okay? So that's on the refrigerator, your checkbox. It says Mom and Dad did. That was the first one? Could we do, all right, so I was the second one. Okay, could real quick, just come up with at least one, maybe two, if you could break up into couples. What can you do to raise the bar? What kinds of issues do you foresee, and you need to raise the bar in yourself so that you can answer questions from your kids? Let's do that, if you don't mind. And then on Wednesday night, we're going to circle back and begin the class with this chart. What kinds of ideas did you have, or what can you do for yourself, or what do you find within yourself things that you need to work on? Okay?